Hi, I'm Shekhar Gupta and I bring to you a fresh episode of Cut the Clutter. Before I tell you that this is an unusual episode of Cut the Clutter and why it's unusual and why it's important, let me ask you a question. Which is the most cluttered story, news story that you are watching right now? Which is the most cluttered? Which is the most important? Which is the most confusing? Which is the most troublesome for you? And which is the one which you know goes back a long time, because something that happened a long time back is coming back, including the images? That obviously is the Punjab story. Punjab story, now with the Amritpal Singh phenomenon, his escape, etc., and the fears and the protests that are taking place in London, in San Francisco, in Canada, places like that, among the Sikh diaspora. It is the Punjab story. It is again the idea of the Sikh unrest, rise of a radical preacher of sorts, such as a preacher Amritpal is, because he wasn't a preacher until very recently. But some of the elements of the story look like they are familiar. And that is the reason I thought I will give you this unusual edition. Unusual because this isn't just our normal Cut the Clutter. I am taking you back in history. I'm taking you back exactly 40 years in history. Because a society, a country, a people, a community that tends to forget the worst phases of its history and the lessons that were learned by our earlier generations from that history, unfortunately, is then destined or then is then condemned to be revisited by same kind of a bad phase of history. And that is avoidable. And to avoid that, we must understand and know where exactly are we coming from. And that's the reason I also write this series, first person, second draft. And I had written one four-part series in 2014 on Punjab. And that was sparked by the fact that Punjab, that during the national elections, I traveled around in Punjab looking at some writings on the wall, articles. And in the process, went to the Golden Temple and realized that it was the first time in more than three decades at that point that I was visiting the Golden Temple purely as a devotee. Because in the past, I had always been there, barring my childhood, because I was brought up in those parts. I had always visited the Golden Temple in times of trouble. In times of trouble, when there were battlements, there were weapons, etc., etc. And then the calmness and the serenity of the Golden Temple is something that I experienced now in 2014. And that resulted in a series of articles sort of revisiting what had happened. Once again, when you have memories of the past and then you have the fact checks of the present, what's happened over 30 years then and 40 years now. So one of those was about the Bhindranwale phenomenon. And that is the one that I will tell you about today. So in my many public speaking engagements, the question I'm often asked, most often, particularly when I go to colleges and schools, is to name the three most interesting persons I have met as a journalist. There is a particular curiosity among the millennials and now Generation Z about events in what we may describe as the pre-Google era. At schools and colleges, very young people push me to go beyond the mainstream politicians of today. Tell us about some others we may not be so familiar with. The most interesting. Why not Sir Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale, I ask. I've been wondering though, why should this post-internet generation be made to recall the bad dreams? In fact, one of the worst nightmares of our country's contemporary politics. This is what I used to say until recently. Now, with the latest turn in Punjab, I would no longer say so. I'd say it's better that we learn, that we remember what happened, and we also talk about Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale. Earlier, I would have said, why recall the nightmare that ultimately ended in Indira Gandhi's assassination and then the massacres of Sikhs? Why expose curious 19-year-olds to this when even I keep forgetting the man who defined my working life for an entire year, that is the summer of 1983 to 1984, who gave me many scoops, many stories, many great interviews, great as in very newsy interviews, many memories, and old reporters' tales, but also wrote this country's present and future as no other Indian had done in our post-independence history. Good or bad, evil or nice, that's a value judgment that any of you can make. So why do I think of Bhindranwale when pushed on that most interesting person you've met question. Maybe I'm influenced now by what's going on in Punjab, also by a couple of recent visits to the Golden Temple. So in a way, my 4-decade-old memories are refreshed. It struck me sadly on one of these visits that it was the first time, as I mentioned to you earlier, it was the first time since my early childhood that I was visiting a peaceful Golden Temple as a humble devotee and getting that ultimately benediction, a kada, a steel bangle blessed at the Akal Takht. All my memories and references so far had been my adult memories and references so far had been taken from the 1978-1989 period of various degrees of violence. I start at 1978 because that was when, on Baisakhi Day, 14th April, a clash took place between Bhindranwale supporters and a congregation of the Nirankari sect in Amritsar. 13 of Bhindranwale's followers were killed, and suddenly an unknown young preacher. Remember, when Bhindranwale died in 1984, he was 36, between 36 and 37. 1978, he was just about 29, 30. And that's how this unknown young preacher became a name known nationally. His life ended at just 36 with Operation Blue Star, not only one of the most traumatic events in our history, but also one with the longest lasting consequences. And I apologize for sounding like such an insensitive news hound, but it was also the biggest story of my career. Made so particularly by the fact that when the army banished all the domestic and foreign press on the evening of 3rd June, filling them all onto buses that they had organized, and buses took them straight to Delhi and dropped them there under armed escort, I was among the 3 reporters who managed to stay back to chronicle and later tell the story. One, Subhash Kirpekar of the Times of India then, way senior to us all, is sadly no more. The other was Brahma Chalani. Yes, your famous strategic pundit and TV talking head, who then worked for Associated Press. I may walk the Golden Temple Parikrama as a devotee now, head bowed, but instinctively, inevitably, my points of reference are still the 2 Ramgadhia Bungas of the towers on which the sandbagged machine gun nests of the militants were stockaded, and the image of the bags and bodies sent flying when struck by the army's howitzer. Guru Ramdas Sarai Terrace. Sarai means it's a kind of an inn for pilgrims. That terrace overlooking the Golden Temple where Bhindranwale originally held court and routinely updated his hit lists in public. Basically, it meant adding new names and striking out those who had been sorted out. Or in his language, sod ditte gaye si, right? Sodana. Right? Unko sod do. That means sort them out, whatever. You know what that means. The Akal Takht building, the supreme seat of the Sikh spiritual and temporal power with the authority to issue hukamnamas, the Sikh, which is the Sikh equivalent of encyclicals or ecclesiastical bulls that the Pope issues. These were issued to the Sikh community, where he finally took control of his faith's Vatican, that was at the Akal Takht. He moved from Guru Ramdas Sarai to the Akal Takht, and where he met his end on 6th June 1984. Grenade shrapnel hitting his face first, and then a carbine burst from an infantryman cutting him down. But not before nearly 2,000 lives had been lost, 136 of them from the army. The highest casualties suffered by our armed forces, that is the uniformed armed forces, Army, Navy, Air Force, not paramilitary forces or the police, the highest number of casualties, fatal casualties suffered by our armed forces in a domestic operation ever in 24 hours. And those of anything from 600 to 1,000 innocent pilgrims dead along with Bhindranwale were his most committed lieutenants. Major General retired Shabek Singh, Bhai Amrik Singh, the handsome, articulate and fiery deputy from whose father Bhindranwale had inherited the position of the head of Damdami Taksal, an ancient and conservative religious seminary in Mehta, Chowk Mehta near Gurdaspur, and several others. In many people's book, Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale was a saint. In many more people's book, he wasn't quite so. Nor was he somebody who would conform to the definition of a nice man. But he was the most interesting human being I have ever met and dealt with as a journalist. And God knows I have met more than a few through the years. And he was one of the most talented, charismatic, and in fact, in the end, recklessly courageous man. You had to be so to make a last stand in an ancient building, fighting off repeated assaults by 6 of the finest infantry battalions of the army, besides the commandos, Vijayanta tanks firing from their main guns, armored personnel carriers, or in fact, more accurately, infantry fighting vehicles, BMPs, 3.7-inch mountain howitzers firing in direct mode, helicopter patrols for 36 hours, luring assault troops and young officers into the killing ground between the Akal Takht and the Darshini Deodi, where the causeway to the temple begins, and then cutting them down with machine guns sighted to cover every inch and peeping out of the slits cut out of the Akal Takht's century-old marble walls. You had good defenses, but still had to be nuts to fight there, knowing the inevitability of the end. There was a bit of that to Bhindranwale too, in fact, quite a bit. He had begun to believe the mythologies spread about him by his own devotees, that he was an embodiment of the divine, that his victory and the formation of a new Sikh state were preordained, although he himself never used the K word, as I said in an earlier National Interest article. That in a holy war against the Hindu state, his Sikhs were obviously going to win. He genuinely believed that until the last moment he thought he was going to win. To him, the only inevitability in that murderous June week was fateh or victory. Shikast or defeat was for the BB's forces. BB is how he addressed Indira Gandhi usually. Oh, BB the fauj aa rahi hai, right? The shikast was for the BB's army, Indira Gandhi's army, he said. I was among a very small group of people, including some local reporters, Amritsar-based reporters, whom he gave an audience to over glasses of a herbal concoction, banafsha, as was his preference. Tea and coffee were forbidden, like all intoxicants, just before the army fully slammed the trap shut. In fact, the army had already surrounded and circled the Golden Temple when he gave us that audience. It was a kind of a last supper. See the picture. 3 decades ago, you still have a reporter with sleeves rolled and back rounded in a manner that in later years will be your physio's nightmare. BB and her Hindu Congress, he said, BB Indira Gandhi, BB and her Hindu Congress, he said, had declared war on the Sikhs, and he was ready for the last battle and victory. So I asked him, but how will you fight the might of an entire army? I asked him, several others joined in. They even have tanks lined up near the Kotwali, that's the old police station not far from the Golden Temple. Das deo enanu kis tarah ladoge singo, he said in Punjabi. It was like he was exhorting his followers there and also giving them encouragement. Tell them, you Sikhs, you lions, you tigers, how will you fight? And then he went on to say, you will be victorious. You just have to mentally prepare to fight Russian commandos. Why Russian commandos, Sanchi? I asked. Because Sikhs in the army, he said, and I quote, because Sikhs in the Indian army won't fight us, and the Topiwalas, that is the Hindus, won't be able to withstand us. So BB will have no choice but to seek Russian commandos. And he said this with a smirk that to those familiar with him, usually meant a death sentence. Except in this case, this was like a death wish for himself, almost all his followers present at that point, and thousands of others. My limited hacks vocabulary and pen did not have the descriptive flourish or the turn of phrase to do a portrait of that once in many generations character with any degree of fairness. He was taller than most of us, born in 1947, so a midnight's child, and between 35 to 37 years, he died at 36, 37, had a standout aquiline nose, wiry, vein-studded legs that stood out from his long, loose kurta that just about hung below the traditional Sikh underwear or the kacha, ceremonial kacha, no weapon on his body barring the ritual kirpan, the tiny one, and a trademark stainless steel arrow that he carried as a general, army general, would flaunt his swagger stick. He had brilliant, studied delivery with perfect pauses to let his audiences enjoy his wisecracks or thirst in anticipation of the punchline. Infrared eyes, and most importantly, a laser wit and repartee. Of course, you could never answer back or join an argument with him. Jarnail Singh Bhindranwale did not run a parliament or panchayat in the Golden Temple. His was a court of from another era, with some medieval instant justice. And nobody would dare disagree with him or even protest when he pilloried you with cruel sarcasm or simply piled you with humiliation. My first conversation with him in August 1983 was no different from any other visiting journalists, India or foreign. First conversation. It was similar with all. "Weren't you born a Hindu?" he asked. If it was a foreigner, a European, he would say, "Weren't you born a Christian or a Jew?" Like that. "Weren't you born a Hindu?" he asked. "Yes, Sanchi, though like all Hindus, we pray at the Gurdwaras as well," I said, put somewhat on the defensive already. "Oh, you do? Of course." The smirk appeared now on his face. "So tell me the names of the gods you pray to in your mandir." And then he carried on without waiting for me to answer. "Bhagwan Ram, Bhagwan Krishan, Shiv, Brahma, Vishnu. Have you seen any of them without a full head of hair and beards?" he asked. Now, even if you wanted to say that most of the Hindu iconography was clean-shaven, you did not somehow gather the courage to do so. In fact, nobody did. Christians, Muslims, Parsis, Jews, they were all given the same treatment. "Now, aren't your gods like your father?" he would now ask, and you would have no choice other than to say, "Yes, of course." "So your father, as in your god, never shaved and cut his hair while you are clean-shaven?" he would ask. "What do we call a child who doesn't resemble his father?" He would now turn the knife, or rather give the cue to his congregation, which would then avoid using the word H, but would break into a collective snigger, right? They will not use the word that begins with H in Hindi or Punjabi, but with B in English, but that was the implication. And I quote him again, "That's why I say Shekharji," or whoever his target was that day, "That's why I say Shekharji, Keshan di hatya band karo, stop murdering your hair, literally. Start looking like your forefathers and your gods, so we will call you a decent, legitimate son of them." This was the treatment every visiting journalist was subjected to in full public view of a delirious congregation on his or her first visit. And this somehow softened you. No journalist ever openly contested what he said or argued with him, except to an extent, two in varying degrees. One was our very own Tavleen Singh, herself a very proud Jat Sikh. Bhindranwale never fully got the better of her, but got his cheap thrills and abused his doting congregation by referring to her in her absence, only in her absence, that Sikhni Patrakar, that Sikh woman journalist who plucks her eyebrows. In fact, his exact language was, "Jedi pawan putdi hai," one who plucks her eyebrows. The other, old Satinder Singh, who unfortunately is no more, he was the Tribune's bureau chief in Delhi, and much older than all of us. He was actually film star Devanand's schoolmate and bosom pal and Khushwant Singh's alter ego. He got away with much more. He even got Bhindranwale to laugh, genuinely laugh, not snigger or smirk, when he told him one evening that if Khalistan became a reality, he would have to emigrate to Vilayat, Britain. "Why, Satinderji?" asked Bhindranwale, probably with mock concern. "Don't you think Khalistan will need Buddhijivis, intellectuals too?" "It may, Sanchi, but I will tell you my problem," said the irrepressible Satinder. "Hindus will not let me live in India because I am a Sikh, and you won't let me live in Khalistan because I am padhya likhya, which means well educated. So I will go to England." Now, it was the only time I saw Bhindranwale let someone else win an argument, even if it was a joke. He justified it to the audience, he laughed. He justified it to the audience, however. Something like in any family, there was the odd offspring who was uncontrollable or irrepressible or incorrigible. You have to tolerate those types. Of course, Bhindranwale was still laughing, in fact, giggling. So this was the only time I ever saw him do that in possibly 30 encounters. Once I froze when I saw him tick off a very old woman who bent forward to touch his feet. He nearly threw her off her feet, admonishing, "Don't you do this. Don't touch my feet. What will people say? An 80-year-old woman and a 36-year-old sant?" So in Punjabi, he said, "Loki ki kehenge? 80 saal di buddhi, 36 saal de sant te pairan nu hath la rahi hai. An 80-year-old woman is touching the feet of a 36-year-old sant." I have often said that the subcontinent specializes in producing a unique type of demagogue with the ability of picking up the grievances of a minority when it is most vulnerable, and then magnifying and amplifying them brilliantly to create wide popular outrage. Even in that formidable pantheon, Bhindranwale was at the very top. One of the finest accounts of the way his court functioned has been written by Tavleen in the chapter she wrote for the book The Punjab Story, where I also contributed a chapter. This was published by Rowley Books after Operation Blue Star and later republished in 2009 on the 25th anniversary of Operation Blue Star. In the same book, Lieutenant General Jagjit Singh Arora, Khushwant Singh, M.B. Kamath, Subhash Kirpekar, who was with us in Amritsar during Blue Star, Sunil Sethi, who unfortunately passed away a few months back, my colleague from India Today, the CPI's Amarjeet Kaur, and I also, as I mentioned, contributed chapters. Tavleen describes the case of one Leher Singh, who Bhindranwale presented to his audience in her presence. I wasn't there that day, by the way. I wasn't present. Only Tavleen was there. His beard looked like it had been rudely hacked with a large knife. He said he was from Jatwali village in Fazilka district, bordering Pakistan, and that his beard had been cut off by a Thanedar, Inspector Bichuram. Thanedar named Bichuram. 6 months later, Bichuram was shot dead. Tavleen wrote later how she never realized then that she had seen a death sentence being delivered in her presence. However devout he was and committed to his faith, Bhindranwale was really not a realized master who had conquered ego and vanity, if otherworldly desires. In any congregation, he always wanted to be the center of attraction and hated anybody stealing the limelight. On several of those visits to the Golden Temple, I was accompanied by, or correction, I accompanied Raghu Rai, the greatest celebrity photographer in 6 decades. Raghu, with his locks, tall wiry frame, shirts in exotic weaves, and had many cameras, humongous lenses dangling from his neck, barely providing tantalizing cover, if at all. Raghu was a real magnet for Bhindranwale's rustic audiences, also with his cameras, because there were so many of them and they were curious. And Bhindranwale did not like that one bit. Particularly when, one winter afternoon at his Sarai Terrace, Guru Ramdas Sarai Terrace, Raghu sat soaking in the sun on the parapet. He attracted a lot of attention. Shekharji, said Bhindranwale, Shekharji, tell your photo wala to get off that mundir, mundir is parapet in Punjabi. Tell your photo wala to get off that mundir, said Bhindranwale. Now, nobody usually asked him why. When he told you to do something, you did it. And it wasn't such an impossible demand. So I told Raghu that nobody usually asked him why. When Bhindranwale asked you for something, you usually did it. And it wasn't such an impossible demand. And so I told Raghu, look, Bhindranwale wanted him to get down and either stand or sit with the congregation on the floor, or he can stand there. Like me, lower than Bhindranwale. Now, Raghu responded in a different way. Why, he said, and I'm quoting Raghuna, why? What is the problem? Raghu, prima donna, if you've ever seen one, albeit a true genius with the camera, he asked with just a hint of petulance. Now it was Bhindranwale's turn to respond. Tell him, Shekharji, to get off that parapet, or he may just roll over and die. He may fall from such height and die, and the whole world will say, Santane mar deta, that the Sant killed him. This time, even Raghu obeyed. On another occasion, possibly just a couple of weeks before Operation Blue Star, I went to see him along with my frequent fellow traveler to Punjab and one of the greatest reporter writers of all times, Edward Baer of Newsweek. Check out his reporter's memoir, Anyone Here Been Raped and Speaks English. He was a fantastic writer and a great reporter. Edward Baer was quite a spirited old man by now, one whom nothing would ever bother or irritate. On long drives through terror-soaked Punjab, he would regale you with stories from the battlefront, reportage, as well as the years he spent as an officer in the Indian Army's Garhwal Regiment before independence. As we got up to leave from Bhindranwale's court, this was at the Akal Takht, he hobbled a bit, as old people, particularly foreigners, do, because they are not used to squatting. Now, Bhindranwale asked, and I quote, why is the Gora, that's a white man, why is the Gora hobbling? Asked Bhindranwale. I asked Baer what Bhindranwale wanted to know. Oh, just tell him my foot has gone to sleep, said Baer, just a little dismissively. And Bhindranwale did not miss that tone, even as I played the honest interpreter. And I quote again Bhindranwale, and I quote, his foot has not gone to sleep, he said, turning to his fully armed audience now. And I quote again, the white man's legs, gore di latna, the white man's legs are trembling at the sight of our Sten guns. Up came a spirited Bole So Nihal. There was no way Bhindranwale was going to let anybody, even a benign old quote-unquote Gora journalist, walk away with the last laugh. Of course, Baird figured the joke was on him, and for once, the reporter with the thickest skin as I had known him lost it. And he said, and I quote again, "Tell him that I am not afraid of those stents." And he said this, wagging his finger. "We used to have a Thompson carbine in the Indian Army, and if you dropped it accidentally, it fired 3 rounds by itself. What do these guys know about guns?" At which point, I grabbed Edward Baird by the waist and dragged him out and myself to safety because you know what? It felt at that moment like the temperature had dropped to minus 30 degrees. Now, I brought you the story until now. A lot happened after this. The Bhindranwale saga doesn't end yet. I will bring it to you in equally graphic detail in the second part of this very unusual episode. I told you, I promised you an unusual episode, and I hope I'm living up to that promise. So wait now for the next one.